ahead and have a seat. Justice Krosky may remain standing because it might suit her back better today. There's that. Don't make anything. State versus Valiant Green, 19 AP 2150. Appearances, please. All right. Good morning. So I have 25 minutes for you, followed by 30 minutes and rebuttal of 5, correct? All right. Please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Jay Pusick, and I represent Mr. Green. I'm going to divide my time here this morning first by talking about why the affidavit in this case fails to state probable cause, and second, why the remedy here is suppression of the blood evidence. We all know that a search warrant affidavit must provide sufficient facts to excite an honest belief in a reasonable mind that the objects sought are linked with the commission of a crime. The affidavit in this case utterly fails to state probable cause when it alleges that Mr. Green drove his vehicle in his own driveway while intoxicated.
Counsel, it says more than that. Isn't the person who signs the warrant permitted to take the reasonable inferences from the affidavit? Okay, I'd like you to look at not the place you started out with, but the statement that is checked on the form. The arrestee was observed to drive slash operate the vehicle by a citizen witness named Nancy, and then her last name is spelled out in the warrant. Wouldn't the person who signed the warrant be able to take a reasonable inference from that a citizen informant saw him drive the vehicle, that he was driving it on a public way?
No.
Why?
Again, when we review this affidavit, right, a reviewing court is confined to the four corners document.
That's what I'm looking at. I read you on four corners.
Correct.
Okay.
And so, indeed, it does say that the citizen witness here observed him operating a vehicle. It doesn't say where. So you have to...
But you have to give a reasonable inference. And would a citizen informant be calling unless that person were operating the vehicle on a street? Why would the person be calling? What would they be calling about?
Sure. I mean, that would, as a hypothetical, I could assume that perhaps they're calling because they saw Mr. Green was intoxicated and they thought maybe perhaps he was about to drive. I mean,
well, that's not what it says. She observed. He was observed. Okay, driving or operating the
vehicle. Sure. Just as he was observed operating the vehicle by the officer in this case, right? That's undoubtedly true.
Right.
But as to where that operation took place.
See, but my concern is that the officer, why we're here is because the officer used the word driveway. If
right.
He left that word off, obviously we wouldn't be here. But her statement is not restrictive to any particular place. And my question to you is, why wasn't it reasonable for the person who signed the warrant to believe her statement meant he was seen driving it on some kind of a public street?
To me, that sort of seems akin to taking a set of facts that don't amount to a crime at all and just assuming because it's an application for a warrant, well, a crime must have occurred. I think
she doesn't decide whether a crime occurred. I think that's for the person that signs the warrant to make that determination. I was just looking at a reasonable factual inference, and my question to you is, why isn't it a reasonable factual inference that she saw him driving his car on some kind of a public way?
Because there's nothing in this affidavit to suggest that.
Well, why would she be an informant then that the officer would put in his affidavit? What's she informing the officer of,
well,
and why did he put it in there?
I mean, the worksheet here that the officer filled out has a box for this operating essentially was observed by a citizen witness, and then there's a blank for him to fill in what
sure,
she did.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So, okay, he knows that a citizen witness has observed some operating in this case, and he writes it in. But again, I think you have to take it one step further and make some type of allegation that the driving, or something from which you can make a reasonable inference that the driving took place in a public space or on a highway.
Why?
Because that it's not a crime otherwise.
I know, but the witness doesn't have to allege a crime. She's alleging a fact.
Sure.
Okay, so just why isn't that a reasonable factual inference that the person that called police on him and informed that he was driving or operating his vehicle, why isn't it a reasonable inference that he was operating it on a street?
Sure. I mean, let me take it a step back. I certainly agree with you that it's not the citizen witness's task to establish a crime or to determine in their opinion that a crime was committed.
Right.
But again, I think you have to have some additional facts here, because it's certainly possible for someone to operate a motor vehicle, be intoxicated, and be in the driveway of their single family residence. Not a crime. Not even close to a crime, unless they leave that driveway and enter the roadway or some type of space held open to the public. And so, just as the officer, when he pulled up, we know, right, looking outside of the affidavit, we know that the officer pulled up, saw Mr. Green in the driveway of his home, operating the vehicle. The vehicle moved forward to the edge of the driveway, moved back, moved forward again, moved back, all while remaining in the driveway. The officer observed the operation there, but he never observed a crime. And that's what's written in this affidavit, what the officer saw. He was in his driveway. He was operating the motor vehicle. The officer saw that, and apparently Nancy saw it as well.
She, according to what we have, is that she called the police on him.
Right.
Okay. So I don't think that you have anything in this affidavit that says she saw him operating the vehicle in his driveway.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can all attest to the fact that people call the police for things that aren't crimes all the time.
Sure.
So to suggest
maybe
that...
Maybe he wasn't intoxicated either. She just thought he was, and that's why she called.
Sure. And that, I guess, equally so, if it had said in another little box under here, the citizen witness believed the defendant to be intoxicated without any further facts upon which to, you know, see and test that conclusion, that wouldn't be enough, right? The officer certainly establishes the likelihood of intoxication on the second page. But I guess my point would be that when you're trying to figure out what is alleged here, and it says a citizen witness saw this driving, I think you got to go back to any place where it alleges where driving took place. And the only indication in this whole affidavit of where driving took place...
But, you know, probable cause is not equal to guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's fine in probable cause to have doubts about a fact that is inferred. I mean, that's why we have trials all the time. We have probable cause, we issue an arrest warrant, we have a trial on those facts.
Sure.
Did the fact that you inferred actually occur, or was that an incorrect inference?
Right, but again, this is pretty bare bones here. There's no, just because it says he operated his motor vehicle, you can't, you know, which isn't necessarily a crime.
No.
Where does the I guess I don't see where the inference comes from that it was a crime, I guess simply because she called the police or because there was a search warrant being applied for. I don't think that gets you there. That would make pretty much every application for a search warrant. That would fill in a lot of holes, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a search warrant application. The police were called, and so there must be a crime here somewhere.
Could I switch gears, no pun intended, and switch to the... Actually, it was kind of intended.
Yeah, I
guess. Sorry. I don't know if it's better to admit it or not to admit it.
I think sit down.
Okay. Fair enough. I want to talk to you... My question is going to deal with the good faith exception. And I'm looking at Leon, and I see the four circumstances there, which you talk about in your brief. And then you go on to discuss Eason. And my question is about the holding in Eason. And you note in your brief that Under Eason, for a good faith exception to apply, it must be reviewed by someone other than the officer who drafts the search warrant. I'm looking at paragraph 63 of Eason, and the holding sentence in there doesn't say that. If you can't see, get to where I am.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. So I recognize that the first two sentences do talk about that, and they are the opinion is referencing a Yale Law Review article. But then it goes on to say that this is what we require, that for a good faith exception to apply, the state must show that the process used attendant to obtaining the search warrant included a significant investigation and review by a police officer trained in or very knowledgeable of the legal, what is that word? Vagaries of probable cause and reasonable suspicion, or a knowledgeable government attorney. So my question is, I'm not seeing the requirement that someone other than the officer who drafts the search warrant has to okay it in some way. And I'm not sure that in practice that is what happens. So I'm just, help me understand why you think that is part of the test.
Yeah, I guess I'll begin by saying that certainly Your Honor is pointing out that I can't disagree that the language that is used in the passage that you read explicitly states that it's got to be someone other than the drafter. It's possible, right? It's implicit in there. And I think to sort of solve that problem, when you read Eason as a whole, it makes it pretty clear that it is required, right? I mean, they first start by talking about how, I mean, these requirements, I read them as being rooted in Leon itself, right? Because the court says, you know, most investigations in most large jurisdictions, these things are done regularly. As they were in Leon, right? Leon involved a significant investigation as well as a review by numerous deputy district attorneys, right? And so, first of all, they're rooting it in Leon and saying, this isn't a big deal. This is what happens in most of these cases. It's what happened in Leon. And then they go on to say, you know, in paragraph 62, in most large jurisdictions, a line officer who wants to obtain a warrant must present the project either to a superior within the police organization or to a government attorney. And then it goes on to sort of, you know, justify that, hey, having somebody else have eyes on this project for a search warrant is going to take away some of these specious, fishing expeditions by line-level officers. And I think when you read those passages together with the passage that Your Honor read, I think it makes it clear that somebody else besides the drafting officer has to review it. In addition to that, as I sort of pointed out, I think in my reply brief, it doesn't make a lot of sense that it would just be the officer that drafts it, right? Because if that were the standard, if that were the lowest, you know, denominator here, first of all, that's where it's going to go, right? We all know in practice, you know, you referred to the practice, that's where it's going to go. Well, we're going to do the least amount of work possible. So why require either a government attorney or just the officer that happens to draft the brief? Because in every case, right, every single police officer in this state that's certified to work is trained in the law of the Fourth Amendment. That is universally true. And so, arguably, every police officer in this state is trained in the vagaries of probable cause and reasonable suspicion.
Would you be making the same argument today if the word driveway was not in the affidavit for a warrant?
So the question is, let me just make sure I'm understanding. You're saying this whole claim, if the affidavit simply said that Mr. Green was operating at 3207 45th Street in Kenosha?
Right.
No.
So the word driveway is the fatal flaw to this warrant?
Correct.
So when it doesn't say on the driveway, it says at.
Right.
So, and then followed immediately after the street has in parentheses name of road/highway, because obviously the first element has that as part of the element, right? That you operate or drive a motor vehicle on a highway, right? And so when the judge sees this and sees, gosh, this is the location of the road or highway area that this vehicle was operating, it'd be fine if the word driveway wasn't on it.
I think so, yes.
So it doesn't say on the driveway, though. It says at. So there are roads that go by driveways. So the officer was pretty precise here, but isn't your argument flawed because of the lack of the word on?
No. The, you know, as you know, let's go back to your question, right? If this affidavit said that Mr. Green was operating at 3207 45th Street, I think that that reasonably conveys that he is on 45th Street at that address, okay? And that, you know, that is the usual inference that gets drawn in these warrants, in these cases.
Because if it's not on a road or highway, it doesn't meet the first element, right? So if you don't have some reason to believe it's on a road or highway, it's not going to meet the first element.
Right.
So that's why the warrant itself requires that you name the road or highway.
Correct.
And that's directly in the parenthetical. And the description of the road or highway is the driveway of 3207 45th Street. It's at that driveway. The road or highway is at that driveway. That's what it says. So I'm just trying to figure out where exactly you draw the line. Because it doesn't say operated on the driveway. It says at the driveway of that road or highway.
Sure. And, you know, let me put it this way.
Because there'd be no search warrant if it's in the driveway or on the driveway.
Right.
It has to be on a highway.
Right. And so, I mean, there's a multitude of different ways that this warrant could have been drafted to make it sufficient, right? My point here is that the way that it is drafted, it's insufficient.
Because of the word driveway.
Right. Because any interpretation, any reasonable interpretation of this affidavit has to give some meaning to that word, has to give some meaningful meaning to the word driveway. And so
it's a precise location on the highway. That's what it seems to say, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I disagree with that. I think, you know, if you wanted to use the driveway as a reference point, you could certainly say, you know, it could have said, hypothetically, right, at, you know, 45th Street at the driveway of 3207, right? Typically when officers or when, you know, criminal justice clinicians work on these issues, right, it's either at an intersection, so 45th Street at Broadway, Main Street at First Street. Right, that could be written in here to indicate a place on the highway.
We're talking about probable cause in a warrant. It's your burden at this stage, right?
Right.
So what is the burden of proof that you have to show that this warrant is so flawed that it cannot state probable cause?
Well, you know, as you review this warrant, as the reviewing court, you know, I sort of opened up with the standard that it's got to meet, right? It's got to provide sufficient facts to excite an honest belief in a reasonable mind that the objects sought are connected to a crime. You know, furthermore, it has to create a substantial basis.
Does it have to be clearly insufficient under DeSchmidt?
Correct.
Okay.
And so, you know, obviously, this is clearly deficient, again, because we're talking about something that occurred within somebody's driveway. I think the best way to illustrate this point...
It doesn't say in the driveway, though. That's kind of...
Yeah, but it also... I mean, but at the driveway could also... I mean, we're sort of, you know, going through the semantics. At the driveway could mean, you know, physically in the driveway. It could mean, you know, that like the Court of Appeals decision here.
Yeah, but the words road and highway are on there. So without,
I mean,
the first element is operating on the highway. So you have the officer saying, you know, this is the evidence I have that this person is operating on the highway, and this is the area of the highway where this person's operating.
But it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't, he didn't write that it was, I mean, what you're referring to is a parenthesis as a direction to the officer, what's the name of the road or highway. He didn't.
If you were presenting this to me and I were the trial judge, I might say, I need further clarification on this. This isn't, I need to know, was it in the driveway?
Right.
And then ask for more detail. But the judge didn't hear. So now you're challenging the warrant. Mr. Green was found guilty, so there must have been some evidence of, circumstantial or not, must have been some evidence of operating on a highway. Otherwise, it gets kicked at trial. I mean, there's insufficient proof if there isn't anything. So the issue we're dealing with now is whether you can meet the burden of showing that this is clearly insufficient.
And it is. I mean, if you look at what the officer wrote here, he didn't, you know, he wrote an address and the driveway of an address and then the name of a highway. So let me just quickly try to illuminate my point here about this. Is what if think about what this would mean if you put in a different word instead of driveway. What if it said at garage of 3207 45th Street or at backyard? I don't think anybody here would argue that reasonably meant it was on the road near the garage, right, or near the backyard. Although both are theoretically true, that the garage and the road are relatively near to the highway. But you can't just add in random words and not give them meaning and just say, well, it's close enough. I mean, you know, I think what happened here is the officer wrote what he saw. He saw Mr. Green driving within his driveway, and that's what he wrote. And unfortunately for this situation and for him, it's deficient. It doesn't state a crime.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals didn't focus on a word like on, but the Court of Appeals said at means near.
Right.
And when I first got this case, being a former English teacher also made me pause, right? That means near. But how does that conform with the admonition that penal statutes must be narrowly construed? So I'll forget Merriam-Webster at the moment, but how penal statutes must be narrowly construed. And that's what caught my attention in this case.
Sure. And, you know, I think that's certainly an interesting argument to make, that, you know, here we have Mr. Green being alleged to operate a motor vehicle. It clearly alleges that. It alleges clearly that he was drinking alcohol. It alleges pretty clearly that he was likely intoxicated. And so the question comes down to, you know, does it allege that he committed a crime? Because none of those things even taken together are a crime. And so the only indication as to where he drove was this at driveway. And I have to admit, you know, when I first looked at it, it seemed obvious to me that this was deficient, that it was just within the driveway that he drove, and I think that is honestly what the reviewing circuit court, who happened to be the one that signed the warrant, also thought.
The circuit court acknowledged that he made an error on page
correct.
6 of the transcript.
Correct.
He made an error in signing it without asking further questions because of the driveway.
Correct. And doesn't that, you know, it drives home the point here that this conclusion that was made by the Court of Appeals is an unreasonable one here, that in this case, you know, at can mean near. You know, we're just going to assume that a crime occurred because, you know, this is a warrant alleging, you know, for search of evidence. And I don't think you can go that far. I think that Your Honor is correct in that, you know, by saying he drove at his driveway, it's got to be construed to mean that he was driving within his driveway.
What significance do you give to the fact that at is part of the pre-printed form? I mean, aren't they just saying, you know, they didn't really mean at, they just put driveway, and I mean, what? That's an argument. What's the significance?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I wrote about that in the brief. I mean, that does carry weight with me that, you know, this is a worksheet form. The officer didn't write the word at. That's just on the form. what he wrote was that, you know, when he's filling this form out, what is in his mind? He's thinking, well, where did the driving take place? In the driveway of 3207 45th Street. And so, I mean, I don't want to go too far down that road. I think that this is an objective standard, and whatever subjective things were in his mind about this warrant are pretty irrelevant. But in trying to dissect what happened here, I think that certainly he's writing where he saw the driving took place.
Well, should we ignore all the pre-printed words on the form then?
I don't. Obviously, you don't ignore them.
Well, I mean, you could make a lot of hay over a lot of the words. If you know, they're pre-printed, and without them, there is no probable cause.
Sure.
That's probably why they pre-printed them, by the way, so that they wouldn't have a flawed warrant that is a pre-printed form. I mean, road and highways pre-printed too, so. Maybe.
Right. But I don't think, I mean, that's not part of the language of the, I see I have a red light.
Go ahead, you can answer
okay.
my question.
I mean, the road, name of road or highway is, it's in parentheses, it's italicized. I think it's just directing the officer who's filling this out, like, this is where you put this information. It's not, I don't read that as an allegation that this happened on a road or highway. Because, of course, you can violate the OWI statutes and not be on a road or highway, right? You could be in the pick and save parking lot.
Well, the standard instruction says highway, but yeah. Potentially you could. That'd be a different battle for a different day, which is not yours, so you can go ahead and sit down for now.
Thank you.
Thanks.
May it please the court, good morning. As I said, I'm Assistant Attorney General John Blimling on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. There's been a lot of discussion here, and I agree with the basic legal principles that are put out here. The Constitution favors searches conducted pursuant to warrants. And because of that preference, the warrants that are issued by a judge or magistrate get a certain level of deference, and that deference really sort of rears its head as any reasonable inference that a warrant contains probable cause, it should be affirmed then by a reviewing court. So I'd ask this court to kind of keep that in mind and also keep in mind the big picture here. That is that Officer Poffenberger indisputably had probable cause that Valiant Green drove drunk in the road.
Why does that matter? If an officer has all kinds of things and never tells the magistrate signing it, tell us why that matters.
So that
we're limited to what they give the magistrate, right? Sure. Or judge, or I mean, it says magistrate, but here, judge in Kenosha County. Why does it matter what he knew otherwise?
I apologize because I may have kind of muddled my points there a little bit. That is less about whether there was probable cause and more about the second point, which is whether the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule would apply. And I do want to talk about both of those, but I'd like to start with probable cause, if I may, and I will come back to that, though, Justice Dowd.
Let's start with probable cause. Would a objectively reasonable officer think there was a well-trained officer, trained officer, think that it was a crime to operate a motor vehicle in a residential driveway?
No.
So you agree that would be objectively unreasonable. Is that correct?
I generally agree with that. Yeah, you know, caveat being it may depend on the driveway, but not this driveway.
I said residential. Yeah, just
right.
For
and
that
even
reason. We have cases that talk about, I mean, the statute defines highway, the statute defines driveway, the statute specifically says that OWI does not apply to a residential driveway, specifically only to a highway. It cuts out that specifically. So it seems to me that an objectively reasonable officer, knowing that that's what the statute says, and OWI is such a matter of a common, way too common offense that a trained officer knows that it does not apply to someone operating a motor vehicle in a driveway. There is no crime. Is that correct?
I agree with that, yes.
Okay.
Yes. So if you look...
I'm looking at the counts of, and I'm thinking back on how many of the criminal complaints and other things I've approved for probable cause. The charges in a typical count one for operating while intoxicated would be that on a particular date at a particular time in a city, in a county, in the state of Wisconsin. Then it just says did operate a motor vehicle while under the influence of an intoxicant in violation of certain statutes. It doesn't outline in there either that there's a highway. So maybe every criminal complaint would be fatally flawed as well. Because a judge is finding probable cause of that, but it does not say that you're on a public highway in the state.
So I think that the state agrees with the general principle that you have to operate on a highway in order to have an OWI offense. And I don't want to get too far afield of how that looks in the context of this particular case, specifically with regard to whether there was probable cause in the warrant. The state's not advancing a position that the warrant established probable cause despite the fact that it didn't allege driving on a highway. The state's position is that the warrant did allege that he drove on a highway, and I think there's two ways that you get there. I think the first is kind of the approach that the Court of Appeals took, which is when you look at meaning near.
When you were in the Court of Appeals, what was the argument of the state? It, as I recall reading, it wasn't that this was sufficient.
Yeah.
Am I correct?
You are correct, Justice Bradley. At the Court of Appeals, I limited argument to essentially the basis on which the circuit court found that the exclusionary rule would not apply. And so I sort of limited my argument there. I've opened up my argument for this court, particularly because of the Court of Appeals decision.
Yes. In fact, you can't see behind this mask, but I'm smiling. Is opening up an argument the same thing as changing it?
You were the English teacher, so you might have a better sense than I would of the semantics of that. I can say that generally speaking, I do think that the Court of Appeals opinion is correct. It raises some good issues, and I would be remiss if I simply let that go by the wayside.
Absolutely, you would be. Well, I can understand. I don't want to say absolutely you would be remiss, but good old English teacher, at least towards part of your brief, I circled all the ifs. If there was. You know, if this was adequate, let me pull your brief. It was like page 22, page 24, page 26. So you were hedging a bit even here as to whether or not this affidavit is sufficient. It seemed to me, with all of the ifs, I can pull it.
I think that, if anything, that may just be a tick of my writing, especially when I'm in the same brief advancing an alternative argument. It's all probably there. So in terms of the two ways that I think that you do get to probable cause looking at the warrant affidavit is versus the Court of Appeals approach, which is interpreting at to mean near the driveway, i.e. in the road. But even if you take at the driveway to mean Officer Poffenberger saw him operating in the driveway, I do still think you can get to a reasonable inference that he's in the driveway, he was just driving in the street. And so I do think that there are two ways.
Isn't that dangerous? If it said in the driveway, we could surmise that he had already driven out onto the street. You really want us to hold that for purposes of affidavits that come in front of judges, that all we have to do is kind of say, oh, in the driveway?
I think that decision would afford the proper deference to the decision that has already been made by the circuit court to issue the search warrant. When you look at the, there was a question about the standard of review that this court looks at all of this, and it is a question of constitutional fact. I don't think any facts are in dispute in this case, so it is a question of applying the facts to the law here. But the law also states that the probable cause determination by the magistrate or the issuing judge gets that deference of any reasonable inferences. And it also says that close cases essentially are resolved in favor of the probable cause determination. So, you know, is a bare sort of assertion. I understand why that's maybe a bit, you know, not how you would interpret the warrant, Justice Dallet, if it came across your desk at a trial court, but I think owing the appropriate deference under the standard, it is another way that you could review the warrant.
Isn't your deference inference argument swallowing either or both the statute and the constitutional provision, Article 1, Section 11? It seems to me, this is why, and then respond. I mean, not only does 346.61 say it has to be on a highway in order for OWI laws to be applicable, but it goes on to state specifically it cannot be in a single family residence, a parking area in a single family. I'll read it. Private parking area at farms or single family residences, right? So are you saying that regardless of, let's say we get rid of this at issue, driveway, he operated in a driveway, and if a judge had that counsel as the affidavit, that a reviewing court should say, it's a reasonable inference that it really is the street? That just seems to obliterate what the legislature set forth here and the requirements of 111, Article 1, Section 11, which is the same as the Fourth Amendment, that a warrant shall not issue but under oath or affirmation and with probable cause for a crime to be committed. I'm adding for a crime to be committed.
Yes, so in terms of dropping the at, I mean, the at is in the warrant application. I understand sort of the hypothetical to test the parameters here, but...
Yes, that's what I'm doing, because it seemed to me I heard you say that a reasonable inference from being on the driveway is that it was driving on the road, and that causes me to pause.
Sure. And I would say, you know, had just driven on the road, that's not the primary argument that I advance in briefing. I think the Court of Appeals is certainly the approach that I would take on interpreting the probable cause as contained in the warrant affidavit here. So.
Thank you.
I do want to turn to the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule that was the subject of some discussion and in the briefing and here today. And Leon and Eason and kind of how they fit together. You know, Leon talks about the exclusionary rule and how it gives four examples of when the good faith exception might not apply. Three of those, I think, pretty clearly don't apply here. There's been no argument that there was misleading of the court, or that the court abandoned its neutral stance, or that there was some facial invalidity in terms of like a mis. What we look at for Leon is whether the warrant application was so defective that no reasonable officer could rely on it, and I think that has to mean something more than the deference that's already afforded to the issuance of the warrant itself. Otherwise, that wouldn't be sort of a separate consideration under Leon. That is to say that if you look at this and you say, okay, well, we apply the appropriate deference to the issuance of the warrant, but even under that deference, we don't think there was probable cause in the warrant. I don't think you can look at that the same way and say, and for that reason, you also have not met that third Leon category, situation factor, whatever you want to call it. I do think it needs to be something beyond that. And because this is so close a case to begin with, I think that third Eason factor, I think is, or I'm sorry, the third Leon category there is kind of difficult for Mr. Green to establish here. In terms of Eason,
I'm going to pause because it was the third Leon factor which led me to ask the question that I did to you at the outset about a objectively reasonable officer trained would think that you can, it's a crime to operate in a driveway. And you agreed, no objectively reasonable officer would think that's a crime. And to me that is somewhat dovetailed with no reasonably well-trained officer should rely on the warrant because the affidavit is so lacking in the indicia of probable cause. So I kind of thought my question was targeted at that, but maybe I was wrong. And so help enlighten me.
Sure. So I guess I would ask sort of rhetorically, is there a situation
Don't ask me.
I'll ask myself aloud.
Okay.
Is there a situation in which an officer could have a reasonable belief that the warrant states probable cause and a reviewing court has determined that it does not? And again, I would return to the fact that the fact that this is included as a possibility in Leon, I think, means that it has to exist. That scenario has to exist. Now, what does that look like here? I think it looks like Officer Poffenberger reasonably believed, that the manner in which he filled out the warrant affidavit established all the probable cause that he undoubtedly had. And this kind of comes back to Justice Dowd's question early on about why does it matter that he undoubtedly had probable cause. It goes, I think, to the reasonableness of his belief. So he could reasonably believe that he had conveyed that information that he had thoroughly.
Subjectively or objectively?
Well, I think it is an objective test. It's a reasonable officer test. But generally, we look at sort of a reasonable officer in the shoes of that officer. And so you kind of have to look at the totality of the circumstances when you're reviewing this. And so I think, again, the fact that this third Leon category exists really requires that there has to be some situation, because it's not just Wisconsin state law that we defer to the issuance of the warrant. That's federal constitutional law as well, as is Leon. So they know this, and that law has to fit together somehow. And there simply wouldn't be a situation, if you could say categorically, that every deficient, that is lacking probable cause warrant, automatically fails that third category in Leon as well. So turning to Eason a little bit, I do want to talk a little bit about what Justice Kurofsky brought up during the opening presentation here. And that is sort of looking at these two additional factors that are required in order for the good faith exception in Eason to apply under the Wisconsin Constitution. Broadly speaking, I think that when you look at what is required for the good faith exception to apply, you're sort of making a judicial statement on what is appropriate police officer behavior. What do we expect the police to do? And when you look at Eason, you have a situation where the police are applying for a no-knock search warrant. And so they do work hand-in-hand with the district attorney's office, I think, in that case, and get review of the warrant application. Now, I think it's critical that Eason predated McNeely. And McNeely, of course, opened up this whole world of search warrants that were not being obtained, were not being sought, and weren't even considered at the time Eason went into effect. To apply the Eason factors to a situation like this, again, I think it's a judicial statement that Officer Poffenberger should have run this warrant by somebody else. And that would be the same case if it were a roadside stop at 2 in the morning. And I don't think that that really holds up anymore under the way that search warrants are sought and obtained in a post-McNeely world.
Aren't they still obtained, at least when I was doing them, which was post-McNeely as well? Aren't they still sought with a government official, the ADA, approving or signing off on them? And did that happen here?
So I don't believe that an ADA is signing off on roadside photo-dry warrants.
So they just take it right to the judge themselves? Doesn't the DA, I mean, I used to get woken up.
So my understanding, and I think this varies county by county, I did talk to Kenosha County ADA about this case just to find out what their current procedure is. It's not in the record.
And I don't want to get you to get outside the record, but I guess for the record, do we have any evidence that anyone else reviewed it here? I guess that's
I would say the record is undisputed that no one besides Officer Poffenberger himself reviewed it. There is some reference to a couple other officers being involved in the whole process of that, but there's no suggestion, and I'm not suggesting that there is.
Okay. Thank you.
So I'll leave it at that in terms of what actually happens when a warrant gets obtained now. But what I would say is that, again, I think in the post-McNeely world, to have this sort of judicial statement on what is required in order to have good faith apply, you'd effectively be saying, well, again, if you have a roadside stop, 2 o'clock in the morning, and the officer doesn't wake up an ADA to sign off on the warrant, they haven't actually done their job entirely well, and I just don't think that's right.
Or isn't the statement that they should just do their job, and if for some reason they don't, maybe they don't get the benefit of good faith? I mean, wouldn't that really be the statement?
Well, the question is, what do you mean by do their job? And if the
Present probable cause to a judge before you get a warrant.
The good faith exception to apply assumes that probable cause didn't make it. So that ship is kind of already sailed by the time you're doing. And so the question is whether the officer's actions were reasonable. And so if like the law simply just doesn't say that if an officer presents a warrant that it turns out doesn't have probable cause, that that's categorically unreasonable. The law doesn't say that because the existence of the good faith exception exists specifically for that reason. So to look at these two Eason factors and how they take effect in the post-McNeely OWI context is specifically what I think I'm interested in for purposes of this case. You know, what does a reasonable investigation look like? I think that happened here. I don't think there's much dispute on that. I think a reasonable investigation is going to vary kind of case by case, circumstance by circumstance, but, you know, there were certainly steps taken here. But I think to say that the law requires sign off from a third party on that warrant, I think is probably no longer accurate.
Is that true in part because we have a form affidavit here, which I don't know, I'm assuming some lawyers were probably involved in drafting a form that's going to be used quite widely, where it lays out the law and it's, you know, a fill in the blank and a check the box. Does that somehow satisfy the Eason requirement?
I haven't made that argument specifically. I think that's a fair interpretation of it that I honestly hadn't considered, kind of putting it together in that way. And I would also add that there's nothing in the record that states specifically the genesis of that warrant affidavit form, so I can't say. I think at the bottom it does have a form. Well, it says form number one, so I don't know that there's a lot that could be gleaned from that, but I do think that's a point there. I think the other way that you could look at it and whether the Eason factors, so there's are the Eason factors satisfied or should they even apply in this case in the first instance? If you look at Eason adopted this Donald Dripps Yale Law Journal article. And I, as I pointed out in the brief, Professor Dripps did say somebody other than the officer himself.
In fact, that quote needing internal review is at the first sentence, as I recall, in paragraph 63. Part of 63 was quoted before in questions, but it talks about Dripps' article saying requires an internal review. Do you want me to read it to you?
I don't remember the specific wording, Your Honor. I defer to you on that. But if you read the Dripps article and sort of the context in which the Eason Court adopted the Dripps article, it was specifically to avoid situations where there was no probable cause. And here you have a situation where there undoubtedly is probable cause. So I would debate that the Eason factors are even necessary in a situation where there is indisputable probable cause to obtain the warrant, because having those extra requirements in order to, because again, the exclusionary rule is all about deterrence. You're trying to influence police behavior. And in those two requirements, in order to get around the exclusionary rule, you're trying to influence police behavior in order to make sure that there is enough established probable cause that you don't have situations where people are being searched without probable cause. That didn't happen here.
So all they need is probable cause. They don't have to show it to the officer, to the judge, under your reasoning, and therefore we're going to now rely on officers to make the decision instead of judges to make the decision about what is probable cause.
No, they absolutely have to show it to the judge.
Well, they don't under your reasoning. As long as they have it, it's fine. It's good faith. I mean, that's what I just heard you say. So push back on that.
That's not my reasoning, and if it sounded like that was my reasoning, I was imprecise, and let me please try to clarify. The good faith exception is reliance on a validly issued warrant. So in order to have a validly issued warrant, you have to have review by a magistrate or a judge. And that's what happened here. I would not argue good faith reliance on the fact that they might have gone and gotten a warrant if they wanted to. That's not what I'm arguing, and I'm not saying that the good faith exception would apply in such a circumstance. But they have the warrant, and that is what they're relying on. So necessarily, a judge or magistrate has reviewed it.
Counsel, that your comments tie into, in my mind, the inevitable discovery doctrine, which you have posited as an alternative approach here if it is found that the affidavit is deficient vis-a-vis probable cause. And the argument advanced, and actually the circuit court also embraced this, it seemed to me. Even if I did err, there is probable cause here, and then earlier in page 6, I should have maybe asked more questions. Your argument was brief in your brief on inevitable discovery. So give me your best shot on, hey, there's clearly probable cause if you go if the witness statement was attached, for instance. Here the judge thought initially that it was attached and it wasn't. But if it had been attached, there's probable cause, certainly, and I think it's uncontested. Inevitable discovery, please.
So thank you. And I was actually hoping to get into inevitable discovery when my orange light came on, so I appreciate that. I will admit that there is not a lot on this sort of application of inevitable discovery in the law. I cannot point to a case where this has happened. I would note that in State versus Marquardt, I believe it was the second time through, when the Court of Appeals certified the issue, did ask about inevitable discovery, and it came up again in front of this court. This court never reached it, but it is an application of inevitable discovery that the state has advanced before. I would say in the particular context, I'd be asking for a very limited application of inevitable discovery here. I think it applies because you have undisputed probable cause in this case, and you have the act of actually seeking to get a search warrant for the blood draw. So the question is, but for the constitutional failure here, what would have happened? And depending on how you look at the constitutional failure, it's either the failure of Officer Poffenberger to include it in the affidavit, or it's the failure of the court to screen it out without issuing the warrant. I think there can be no debate that what immediately happens there is the court rejects the warrant application, and it is immediately corrected with the probable cause that undoubtedly exists in the case. So I don't think it's this very broad application or incursion of inevitable discovery into a new area. It is, again, it's something that we've suggested in the past, and it is, I think, I'm asking for a pretty limited application of it here, which is simply, what would have happened essentially in this case. I wouldn't ask for it in a situation where, the officer wasn't seeking a warrant, for example. I don't think it would be appropriate there.
What can you hang your hat on for your assertion being something other than hypothetical? That is, well, if the judge found it inadequate, your assertion is that the judge would have said something and there would have been a corrected application. Now, that's hypothetical.
So I think, hypothetical, it depends on how you kind of construe the word hypothetical in the inevitable discovery context. I think even when we say, well, we don't lend itself, inevitable discovery doesn't lend itself to hypotheticals, there's always a little bit of hypothetical there anyways. And so what I would simply say here is the fact that you have interaction between the court and the officer seeking the warrant at that time, and you have the concession that there is probable cause there. So it's not a situation where, oh, well, he would have gone back and gotten the PBT, and the PBT would have pushed the probable cause over the edge, or he would have gone back and found a witness who saw him driving in the street, for example. I think that would be a hypothetical that's too far outside of what's allowable for inevitable discovery. But here, I think, again, there is all of the information that Officer Poffenberger has at the time is tantamount to probable cause, and he's seeking the warrant, so I think inevitable discovery would apply there. I see my red light's on.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Pusick?
Counsel, I have a follow-up question to what the other Justice Bradley just asked your friend on the other side. We actually don't have to resort to hypotheticals or speculation. We can look at the words of the circuit court judge, in this case, the same one who signed off on the warrant and then reviewed his own work and was quite frank about it and said, what I ought to have done was to quiz the officer a bit more and then have the officer submit an amended request with more data. He went on to say the police officer acted quite properly and the failing was that of the neutral. So what's your best argument to counter the facts that we actually have here? We don't need to look at a hypothetical.
Sure. As it relates to inevitable discovery, the first thing I want to say is this would be a very novel and new application of this law. And applying it here would threaten to swallow essentially the whole exclusionary rule or whatever is left of it, right? I mean, this is a situation where you can always sort of have some conjecture. And I think there is still conjecture here, which, of course, the law on inevitable discovery says you can't have elements of conjecture. But, this is sort of a unique case, but also at the same time, I mean, you're assuming that the officer would go back and properly fix this mistake. That is conjecture. He certainly had it within his power to do so, right? But he had it in his power to do so, to draft a good, solid affidavit from the very start, and he didn't do that. Why didn't he do that? It's unclear. It's a pretty simple task, and yet he failed at it.
Is there any evidence that it was misconduct, though? Because ultimately,
yes,
that is what the exclusionary rule, yes, is designed to counter.
Yeah, and I never really got to make a lot of argument about that the first time, but let me be clear about this. Yes, there is misconduct here that is worth using the exclusionary rule to deter, okay? Leon makes that clear. If you look at the analysis and the principles as stated in Leon, they're very clear that the exclusionary rule is only to deter police misconduct.
What was the misconduct?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. So, and yet in Leon, they say, well, wait. this doesn't apply to these four scenarios. And so the misconduct here is that he drafted and relied upon a warrant that was so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to make official belief in its existence unreasonable, or whatever that language is, right? That is why the good faith exception doesn't apply here, because it fits into that third scenario.
Just because he included the word driveway. That's the misconduct.
Because he drafted an affidavit that alleged somebody was driving drunk in their own driveway, which isn't a crime.
Well, I don't want to get into semantics, but they're kind of important here. He didn't draft the affidavit to say in. He said at driveway. And actually, he didn't write at. That's on the form.
Sure. And I think I've made there's been a lot of argument already about the probable cause aspect of it. But let's assume for a second that the conclusion is that this affidavit fails to state probable cause. There's absolutely no legitimate application of the good faith exception in that scenario, right? Because the conclusion is, in that scenario, would be that he had an affidavit that was devoid of probable cause, and it is absolutely misconduct to rely on a warrant that does not state a crime.
But he got it signed by the judge, so that kind of belies your argument.
Right, but that's a little bit. But that's what Leon says, though, right? Is if, even if the deference, and that's another point I wanted to make up here, is the talk about great deference. Leon, that language comes from Leon, right? And Leon says that that great deference, which, you know, if you look at what they say, it applies to cases where there's this fact-intensive sifting through all the things in a complaint that amount to probable cause, and two different people could differ on that. But they say that this great deference that we're talking about is limited, right? There are bounds to that, I think is the language that they use. There are bounds to the deference. And those boundaries are the four scenarios that they said the good faith exception doesn't apply. And again, if the conclusion here is that this affidavit does not state probable cause, then it is so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to make it unreasonable.
What, if any, import does the State versus Tye, T-Y-E case, have in your argument? There, as I recall, there was a concurrence, but it was a unanimous decision, and the warrant signed by the judge had an affidavit that was not done under oath, was not signed, and yet the warrant was signed with the judge. And the rationale was, vis-a-vis the misconduct, that really it was unreasonable because there was no probable cause. Does that apply at all in this case?
So I see that I have a red light.
Go ahead.
I will answer. Okay. So I do think that, I cited Tye in the briefs for, I think, this very reason. And I think it applies on a couple of different levels as we think about what to do in this situation. I mean, one is goes back to the inevitable discovery doctrine. And, you know, if that doctrine applies and saves the evidence here, it certainly should have saved it in Tye. But also, I mean, again, conjecture being what it is, you're assuming, you know, what if the officer drafts another affidavit when the judge rejects it and then he forgets to get it sworn? I mean, there's a lot of different possibilities that could happen, and I think that's why the inevitable doctrine doesn't apply. But yes, I mean, I think this is the application of the good faith exception here. I think Tye can guide us a little bit, because that is also a case where there was undoubtedly probable cause. It was actually in the affidavit, and then there just wasn't a swearing to it. So, I mean, I think that same rationale applies here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for interesting briefs and oral arguments. The court will be in the conference at 1:30.